It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson in for Kate Archer Kent. So that is a well-known sound if you've ever been on a northern lake in Wisconsin. It's the song of the common loon, a black and white water bird. It's a bird that's long been romanticized between its elegant appearance and its eerie cry. While the common loon spends the bulk of its time in the northern reaches of North America, you can find them coast to coast and as far south as central Mexico when they aren't breeding. Now, have you had a memorable encounter with a loon? We want to hear about it. What questions do you have about loon songs, diving ability, plumage, and family life? You can ask our next guest all of your loon-related questions. Call 800-642-1234, or you can email ideas at WPR.org, or you can tweet us at WPR Mornings. James Peruk has been studying loons for about 3 decades and is the author of Loon Lessons, Uncommon Encounters with the Great Northern Diver. James, welcome so much to the morning show.
Hey, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
So loons are one of those animals that people really romanticize, as we mentioned, and feel really passionate about. You've been studying loons for about 30 years now. Do you understand the appeal and the mystique of the loon and why they're so captivating to people?
Absolutely. They're one of the few mega charismatic species of birds that touch all of us. And I think part of it is their vocalizations. You know, you played at the beginning, you know, those haunting calls, I think strike a chord with us in terms of our emotions. I think we have primal vocal centers and, you know, you play like an E minor or D minor chord on a guitar or piano and it touches us, it hits our heartstrings. And I think with the calls that you played for the loons, I think they do that. And secondarily, I would say the fact that you can easily identify a loon on a lake, it's black and white, it's unmistakable. And then the fact that they raise a family, those of us who have children can relate to the arduous task of raising young. I think those characteristics of loons make them romanticized, as you described in the beginning.
Yeah, I really like what you were talking about with that the call and how it kind of tugs at the heartstrings. The first time I heard a loon, I was camping far up north in the Northwoods of Wisconsin, and it was maybe at dawn. It woke me up, but then as soon as it kept crying, I was really moved by the sound of it. You know, that's just my story, but how did you get interested in studying loons?
Yeah, and I was very fortunate too. So my upbringing, I grew up in inner city Detroit, so very urban environment, Wayne County, Michigan, 20,000 people per square mile, I think, in terms of density. My parents didn't hike, camp, or fish. Lovely parents, gave me a great upbringing, childhood, but I just never got exposed to the natural world. And Mutual of Omaha's Wild Kingdom was a show I saw on Sunday nights on TV, and it planted a seed in my mind about being a biologist. And I went camping on Isle Royale National Park there in Lake Superior, and I heard and saw my loons for the first time when I was roughly a high school senior. And that really touched me kind of emotionally. Here's a bird I didn't even know existed, for example, and here they were on the lake. So pretty similar to what you described. And then in a nutshell, to kind of keep things moving along, in college I met a buddy who was attending the same university as I was in Michigan. And he ended up figuring out how to catch loons for his master's degree. His name was Dave Evers. And as a buddy, I went to try to help him catch loons. And when I caught my first loon, I think this was in 1989, you can just imagine putting a loon on your lap, what that's like, the powerful experience that was. And that really got me thinking about studying loons for a career.
And, you know, I'm familiar with the area that you are from, and there really isn't a lot of wildlife or nature in the, you know, the Detroit Hamtramck area. You know, do you think that kind of that having that first experience with the loon, but also your exposure to nature on TV, do you think that really helped enhance your experience because you were not coming from nothing, but like you were definitely not in the most natural of places?
Right. And I think that kind of helped carry my passion because it felt like it was an epiphany moment for me. It was such something so novel. And similarly, I went to school at Lake Superior State University up in Sault Ste. Marie, and there were locals there who grew up in the Upper Peninsula, low population density, and they ended up moving into the city and wanting to live in the city. So they had a different childhood experience. And of course, for me, I came from the city, and it seems like I sought out wild places.
Jim Peruk is the author of Loon Lessons, Uncommon Encounters with the Great Northern Diver. He's been studying loons for nearly 30 years, and you can call in with your own stories about your experiences with loons, or if you have any questions, the number is 800-642-1234. Now, Jim, in your new book, let's get down into kind of the nitty gritty of loon evolution. What do we know about the bird's ancestors?
Yeah, a lot of what we're trying to do is to determine that today is rather than just look at external anatomy, just bones, for example, you know, we can look at the cellular level, extract DNA, and look at similarities of DNA among different birds, for example. And that's really probably the best tool we have to understand the nearest neighbors in terms of loons, for example. And as our understanding of these techniques have evolved, we've gotten a better understanding. So I mentioned in the book, it looks like penguins, as of now, are the closest ancestors to loons, and they shared a common ancestor possibly 50 to 55 million years ago. And loons that we know today, that we see the five species, as I mentioned in the book and you introduced in the introduction, seem to be about 2.5 million years ago in terms of the fossil record, matching up bones with modern skeletons today. So we know they kind of have a long evolutionary history. And the modern ones we see today seem to be fairly current within the last 2.5-3 million years.
Now, you said that they were their closest likely relative is a penguin. That might be a surprise for people who, you know, might be familiar with seeing a loon, but also seeing a duck, just as an example. So these two birds are not related at all.
Yes, correct. And it was interesting. We used to think maybe ducks or grebes, mergansers may have been closest relatives. And the DNA is telling us otherwise. It's suggesting penguins are probably the nearest relatives. And it's interesting, too, because loons are mostly the northern hemisphere and penguins are the southern hemisphere.
Yeah, so it feels like there's that big geographical divide there. So what do we know about how loons evolved over time?
Well, it seems like we see modifications in the skeleton. So they are piscivorous or fish-eating birds. They're master divers, highly efficient at catching fish. And so eventually you took a bird that was terrestrial to move into this new niche, this underwater niche, both freshwater and marine environments, and had to be better at catching a fish, for example, if it was going to be successful. So we see modification of the skeletal system. We see the feet are positioned far posteriorly or towards the back, enlarged feet, added rotation in terms of the joint, enlarged webs, all to help propel the loon to make it streamlined through the water for the ability to kind of, you know, chase down and catch fish.
We are talking to Jim Peruk right now. He is the author of Loon Lessons, Uncommon Encounters with the Great Northern Diver. We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What are some of your favorite loon memories and what questions do you have? Call in now. We'll continue this conversation in just a minute right here on The Morning Show. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. Right now, we are talking about loons. You may know them from their sublime cries or their striking appearance. Our guest has been studying them for nearly 30 years. Jim Peruk is the author of Loon Lessons, Uncommon Encounters with the Great Northern Diver, and we are taking your calls. Have you ever seen a loon on a lake? Have you heard their cries? What questions do you have? Call 800-642-1234. 402-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Now, Jim, before we went to the break, you were describing some of the physiology of the loon. And, you know, one thing, as I was getting ready to talk to you, I watched a video of a loon walk on land. So they're very elegant on the water, but not so much on the land. Can you talk a little bit about, just sticking with that evolution, why they're maybe a little bit more suited for the water versus, you know, dry land?
Sure. One can look at it in terms of a trade-off, for example. And now that the Olympics is coming up, we think about swimming and running events. And those that are for endurance versus sprinting, you know, have a different anatomy in terms of muscles and length, for example. And so using that analogy, if it's helpful, here we see a bird that's extremely specialized for swimming underwater. And there's very few underwater diving birds. So in contrast to a duck like a mallard that might tip and be buoyant, swimming across the surface of the lake, they really are not divers, for example. And so deep diving birds have to have adaptations that allow them to move through the water efficiently. And so their whole anatomy is streamlined. And because they use their legs to propel themselves versus their wings, for example, like a penguin, you know, the legs are far back, large webs to help propel and generate thrust to push the loon, you know, through the water to catch fish. So everything about the loon is streamlined. Think about another analogy as a torpedo, just in terms of its sleekness, aerodynamic. In this case, it would be hydrodynamic, to be extremely smooth, not to have any crests, any bones that are sticking out. So you want the hips to be narrow, the shoulders to be narrow, for example. And if I can just share just another ecological trade-off, is if I had a big, is that okay?
Of course.
Sure. If let's say I have a big keel, and most of us have turkey and chicken, we're familiar with the breast muscle of those birds and the large keel. Well, if a loon had a large keel, that would slow it down swimming underwater. So by having a breast that's very thin, for example, that doesn't have muscle attachment sites, it allows it to move through the water more efficiently. However, the trade-off now is I don't have enough place for large muscle attachments from my chest to propel me to get off the ground. So that's why loons have such long runways, because they've kind of sacrificed, for example, the ability to dive, to have smaller chest muscles and a smaller place of attachment. And consequently, right, it's much difficult for them to get to obtain lift versus a bird like a mallard, for example.
Yeah, it sounds like their physiology still keeps them on the water, keeps them really, you know, suited for the water. You know, Jim, I want to go to one of our callers right now. We have Laura near Dubuque. Hi, Laura. Hi, Laura. Are you there?
Yes.
What did you want to talk about?
I'm sorry. I got to take you off speaker, okay?
All right. We'll go back to... Yep.
Oh, no, I'm here now. I'm sorry. I was at the, of course, I'm on the open road and now I'm at a busy intersection. So my question is, we have a nephew in northern Wisconsin, northwest up, it's 100 miles south of Superior. And they have had this cabin about 6 years and think it's the same pair that mates and it's their lake. So this spring they had two babies. I don't know if that's common or not. I thought it was just one. And they're very concerned about the bald eagle coming down and taking the babies. And so we observe, like, both parents dive at the same time, leaving the babies vulnerable. Is that a legitimate concern of theirs, that these bald eagles are the predators of baby loons?
Thank you for that call, Laura. Jim, loon predators, what should people be on the lookout for?
It's very true that bald eagles can predate, for example, loon chicks and occasionally an adult loon that's incubating its nest. I would say these two animals have kind of coexisted for thousands and thousands of years. So loons are acutely aware of the threat eagles pose. And loons are not the primary target for eagles, for example, but they would be more opportunistic. So it is true. You do need to be concerned, that an adult eagle might land and pick up a chick. I observed that in 1999, for example, on a lake in northern Wisconsin. So it occasionally happens. And the parents have kind of been evolved to kind of pay attention to threats and risks in their environment. And so for the most part, the threat is mostly minimal, but it certainly exists and it does happen.
We are talking to Jim Peruk right now. He's been studying loons for almost 30 years, and he teaches biology at St. Joseph's College and the University of Southern Maine. I want to go back to our callers right now. We have Chris in Oconomowoc. Hi, Chris.
Hey, quick comment or story and then a question. My family has been going to the same cabin in northern Wisconsin in the Cable area for 40 years. And every year we see one pair and one pair of loons only. So one year, my wife and I were up there for our honeymoon for a few weeks, and we got to watch. But the cabin is on the same end of the lake where the loons would nest. So every morning we would watch them training their chick to try to fly and take off over the course of several weeks. And I have to say, when we finally were there that day in the morning watching the chick finally achieve flight and escape the water, it was really one of the most uplifting things I've ever seen. You're just like rooting for the thing. But I'm sorry. So I had a question as well. So I've always noticed when you're on the water, the loons seem very curious about people. Not that they get close, but they definitely check you out. And I guess I wanted to hear more about that behavior, if it's territorial or they're genuinely curious about people. And I'll take my answer off the air.
Chris, thank you so much for that story. That's a lovely story. And thank you for your question. Jim, bird behavior, loon behavior, are they curious or are they maybe just a little bit agitated?
Yeah, I think that's a great story, by the way. I appreciate that, kind of rooting for the chicks. And for example, chicks in Wisconsin are kind of mature, maybe a little faster than chicks in Maine, where I'm from presently. And so they're maybe around week 8, 9, or 10, they might fly, where in Maine there might be weeks 10 or 11, for example. But in terms of the curiosity with people, I certainly have noticed, and others as well, so you're certainly not alone, that loons seem to have a fairly high curiosity index. And most of that is like paying attention to what's in their environment. And I have tried taking like a red bandana, a red shirt during the breeding season. And I think just kind of accentuate, see if they had an interest in red. Now, this was just a very small sample size pilot study, but they certainly came to shore to kind of check out my red shirt. And I was kind of potentially mimicking the red eye, for example. So in terms of the environment, other animals have a high curiosity index. I would say blue jays, which most of us are familiar with, also have a high curiosity index. And I think for loons, that's probably what was happening, is they're kind of paying attention to their environment, and you've kind of moved into their world. And they're mostly checking you out to see if you're a threat, for example.
You know, another part of Chris's story was about, a family of loons raising these chicks. What is the parenting process like? Are there gender roles at all?
Yeah, and what we kind of learned is that loons do not mate for life. So that was popularized on Golden Pond, decades ago. And because of banding efforts by a number of researchers, where you put colored leg bands on their feet, you can follow individuals through time. And so we know that pairs may stay together. They're serially monogamous for maybe 5 to 15 years, for example. But eventually there's going to be a pair turnover and a new mate. There'll be a mate switch, for example. And in terms of parental responsibilities, I was investigating that in the 90s and wondering if it was closer to 50-50 in terms of parental relationships and roles. And I pretty much concluded it was close to a 50-50 partnership. And I think it's an analogy, and it's not always good, I realize, to stretch analogies to humans, but we are humans and we can relate to that. But it's kind of looking at raising children today, like both of us are, both parents are responsible and needed in order to raise children oftentimes because of the tremendous effort involved. It certainly makes life easier. So you see a coordination between pair members. And so going back to like Chris's question, I think that's what you find, or as you mentioned, Jay Carlisle, is that there seems to be a kind of a partnership that evolves and develops between pairs. And pairs that are more refined and more in tune to each other probably are more successful in raising more loon chicks.
We are talking to Jim Peruke right now. He's a biologist, and he's been studying loons for nearly 30 years. We will continue this conversation in just a minute and take your calls at 800-642-1234. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. This is The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. The news is next. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. Right now, we continue our conversation about the great northern diver, the loon. Elegant on the water's surface and torpedo-like underwater, the loon is the very definition of a water bird. Our guest, James Peruke, is a biologist and a loon expert. He's the author of the book Loon Lessons, Uncommon Encounters with the Great Northern Diver. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Share your loon stories, share your questions. Call in now, 800-642-1234, or email ideas at WPR.org. And I want to go to one of our callers right now. We have Stephanie in Minocqua. Hi, Stephanie.
Hello.
What did you want to talk about, Stephanie? Yep.
Oh, yeah, I was kayaking in a lake in northern Wisconsin near Minocqua, and it was spring, early summer. Came around a corner, and there was this big loon spread out with its long neck forward, very threatening posture, and I realized it was on a nest. So then I turned around and started kayaking out of the area, and underneath the boat, there was what I initially thought was a penguin. flipping around black and white under the water, and the reason I thought of a penguin is because I used to go to the Milwaukee County Zoo, and there's that display with the penguins floating around in there. And yeah, so I thought that was pretty funny. I didn't realize it was a loon at first.
Stephanie, thank you so much for sharing that story. And it's amazing that we were talking a little bit earlier about the fact that evolutionarily they might be related to penguins. So we're too far off there, Stephanie. So thank you for that call. And what do you think about Stephanie's tale? She was talking about, a loon protecting a nest, but also demonstrating its water ability in this story.
Yeah, hi, JC. I think it's really fascinating that loons can be aggressive around their nest. And so they probably felt threatened by human recreational, maybe kayaks or canoes, for example. And so they're just kind of defending the eggs. And I know stories where they've attacked canoes and actually probed their bills into canoes and into kayaks. So that's where I thought the story was going to go, where the loon attempted to jab the kayak, which was interesting. And so in terms of that aggression, you can see evolutionarily why that would evolve, right? So animals that care what's happening around their nest are going to be more successful. The other story that just real briefly that seems relevant is we all notice the belly is very white on the loon. So we call it countershading. So it's dark on top, light on the bottom. And the whole aspect of being light on the bottom, we see when loons preen, when they roll over, we see that white color. And we feel that's probably an adaptation to increase its survival in the ocean, for example. So the loons in Wisconsin will make it down to the Gulf of Mexico or the Atlantic side of the Floridian Peninsula. And they do have to worry about large fish as potential threats. So, for example, sharks. There was a shark tooth that was embedded in a loon that washed up on shores in the Carolinas. And so they face real threats. And so the white underneath camouflages them against the light sky. So, for example, if you're a predatory fish looking up at the sky, at the surface of the water, that white belly of a loon would blend in with the sky and you would have a hard time seeing it. So that's probably the best explanation why loons have white bellies, for example.
Now, Jim, I want to shift a little bit to other loon behavior. We have heard a little bit of their song throughout the show this morning. And, you know, as you write in the book, loons have a few vocalizations that can be heard from about 600 feet away or more. There are wails, yodels, tremolos. Let's hear a wail first. And this is courtesy of the Loon Preservation Committee in New Hampshire. So we've heard the wail a few times, but what is a loon communicating with that song?
Yeah, and it's interesting for all the listeners there. We noticed a changed frequency, right? So there was a change in frequency, so almost like a two-note wail. And that is kind of a contact call. It's a bird that's concerned, right? So maybe there's a boat moving into a territory, for example. And so it might try to contact its partner, for example, the other pair member, and might try to get its attention that something's going on around the nest or in our area. So, for example, if they had chicks. And usually what happens is the other pair member comes closer to the originator of that call and may respond as well. And you might have a little back and forth with those whale calls.
And I want to remind our listeners that we are talking to Jim Peruke. He's the author of Loon Lessons: Uncommon Encounters with the Great Northern Diver. He is a loon expert. He's been studying them for nearly 30 years. And you can call in with your questions at 800-642-1234. Now, we mentioned also a tremolo. Let's take a listen to that really quickly. So it's like this quick burst of notes. What is the purpose of the tremolo?
Yeah, and so when we hear the tremolo, for example, those kind of laughing calls that we might have heard, it's really an alarm call. It's a more threatening situation. So if the canoeist, kayaker, boater gets too close, their space feels threatened. And so now the anxiety is heightened. So they move from a wail to a tremolo. And that's communicating to its other pair member, which will usually tremolo back in response. The pair will get closer together. And so a tremolo is, for example, if you hear one, it's possible that you might even be the cause of the, for example, the stress or the anxiety that the bird is experiencing.
And really quickly in that vein, if you are worried that you might be causing stress for a loon, what's the best course of action if you want to be respectful of their space?
Sure. And the best thing is probably to move out of that area, for example, you know, slowly just kayak or canoe away from leaving the loons alone, giving them kind of some kind of threshold, some space, some invisible line where they feel safe. And usually if you move far enough away, you'll notice the calls we'll essentially quit, for example.
Now let's listen to the final vocalization. We have a yodel. So what is that yodel communicating?
So that yodel in this case is only given by male loons. And it seems like it's more of like announcing, here's my territory. I'm willing to defend it. It's not so much to attract mates. For example, like some birds like cardinals and blue jays or robins in our backyard are singing to attract a mate, for example. But common loons, so that when the male gives that yodel call, it's not so much to attract females as it really is to announce the fact that I'm here, this lake is occupied, I'm willing to defend it, for example. And you can tell, like anyone who's seen loons yodel, it's very explosive, lots of energy. In terms of producing the call, they'll often spin in a circle and broadcast that vocalization around the lake. And sometimes on a clear night, those vocalizations can carry 5 to 10 miles.
Oh, wow. That's really far for a bird call. And it feels like an effective way of communicating with others to other males, maybe to back off a little bit. I want to go to our callers right now. We have Dick in New London. Hi, Dick.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. I had an experience in northern Canada canoeing with my brother and his wife on a canoe trip, and this was about 3 hours north of Thunder Bay. We were on the lake, and we rounded an island and came upon 12 to 20 loons all in a congregation, and they were not, we were not terribly close, maybe 50 yards to 100 yards, so they didn't seem intimidated or distracted by us, and they were doing what I could best describe as kind of a ritual dance, where they were doing a call and kind of flapping their wings and engaging each other. I've never seen anything like that or heard of it, and I was just wondering if this was late summer, probably around Labor Day, if this is preparing to fly south or what it was that we saw there.
Dick, thank you so much for that question. Jim, what did Dick see in Northern Ontario?
And this might be the most common question that loon biologists get. And I think about it potentially as a Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde, is during May and June, loons are super aggressive, uber aggressive towards other loons. So that's the Dr. Jekyll part. The same loons, let's say in the end of July, August, and September are like Mr. Hyde, where they're willing to interact and socialize with other loons. So which is a stark contrast in behavior. So during the spring when they're kind of partnering with and breeding and laying eggs, they're uber aggressive. And then what happens is parental responsibilities lax. I think there must be a change in hormones. You know, researchers have not been able to measure those hormones, but I think hormone changes are responsible for a change in behavior. So you might have less testosterone, for example, circulating, less aggressive tendencies. And these loons interact almost as if getting to know other pair members, individuals that are on the lake, in the area, reconnaissance for potential new territories, evaluating the partnership to see if it's stable. Was the pair successful? Do they have young? So we see these kinds of social gatherings that Dick mentioned seem to be highly ritualized and stereotyped in their behaviors. And it's really fascinating to observe. And I'm certainly been intrigued by them as much as everybody else.
Dick, thank you so much for that call. And, you know, another part of Dick's question was whether or not it was that they were preparing to migrate. And we got a caller who couldn't stay with us. Jeff from Iowa wants to know where loons migrate for the winter.
And I have to chuckle because I know a Jeff. I know a Jeff from Iowa. And if that's the same Jeff from Iowa, he's a dear buddy and a great, great biologist. So I'm not sure if it's him, but if it is, it's awesome. And so, again, loons from Wisconsin, most of them are going to fly long-distance migrants, right? They're going to go all the way to the Gulf of Mexico and winter there. On the way down, they'll stop at staging lakes, right? So, for example, Lake Michigan, great place for loons to stop and feed, to put on fat prior to their long-distance migration. Some birds in Wisconsin will also be on the Atlantic side of the Floridian Peninsula as well. But they're long-distance migrants. So, consequently, loons in the interior of the country are smaller than loons, for example, in Vermont, Maine, and New Hampshire, because they're just going to fly a short distance to the ocean. So maybe 100, 200, 250 miles. In contrast to, you know, for something closer to 1,500 miles.
Jeff, I hope that answered your question. We are talking about loons, their evolution, their habitat, and their habits. Our guest is Jim Peruk, biologist, loon expert, and author. And we are still taking your loon stories and questions at 800-642-1234. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. We are talking about loons throughout the rest of the hour. Our guest is James Peruk. He's a biologist who has studied loons for nearly 30 years and is the author of the book Loon Lessons, Uncommon Encounters with the Great Northern Diver. And we are taking your calls at 800-642-1234. And I want to go back to the lines right now. We have Mary in Eau Claire. Hi, Mary.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm fascinated by this. My son is down in New Zealand, and he's studying penguins. Those, and they are different penguins, and they're beautiful. And but I'm wondering, how many babies do they have? How many eggs do they have? And do they? Is there a name for the babies? You know, like swans have cygnets, and you know, and do they have a group? Is what's a group of? They're not mergansers. Then they're what are they?
What Mary, Oh no, keep going. You're good.
Okay. Well, I really would like to know. I always thought they were mergansers.
All right, Mary. Thank you for that call. So some loon terminology. What are baby loons called? What group are they a part of? And more.
Yeah. Real briefly. So loons predominantly will lay two eggs. And in the book, I talk about some biologists have theorized that the two-egg clutch seems to be optimal for loons, that most birds do not lay just one egg in case one's infertile. So they're almost always going to go through the effort of laying two eggs. And then three eggs might put too much pressure on the loon family in terms of the adults to feed them. So the young might actually, you might be able to hatch three, but they might be poorer condition, have less survival. So two eggs seems to be about the optimal clutch size. I'm not aware of any, like, you know, you might hear loonlets, for example, but, you know, as biologists, we've always called them chicks, for example. And in terms of mostly we've always just used the terminology for groups or flocks of loons, for example. And hopefully that helps out the answer to those questions.
Thank you again, Mary, for that call. Going now to Bill in Eau Claire. Hi, Bill.
Hi, how are you today?
Well, what question did you have for us?
Well, the question, I have a rescue story about a loon, a baby loon last year. I live in northwestern Wisconsin, and we live on a lake. And I think it was June of last year, we were driving out from our cabin, which is, the road is probably 400 yards from any water, so it's a landlocked spot. And there was a little black critter by the side of the road, and we pulled over, and it was a baby loon. It seemed healthy. It did not seem injured, but it definitely didn't look like it was mobile at all. So we rescued it, put it in a box, didn't know what to do. Actually took it on the lake where we saw another pair of loons, and really don't know what happened to it. When I put him in the water, he just hustled over to those two loons. But for me, I was baffled at how did a baby loon that did not look like it was mobile at all end up by the side of the road 400 yards from any water source?
Bill, thank you for that call. So any potential ideas about what might have happened there?
Sure. Loons will nest on really small bodies of water, for example, on occasion. It's less optimal. Obviously, you'd want to have a larger lake. So I'm curious about Bill's lake or the ones that were in the area. So loons might nest on the lake, but they might actually call. And within the first 2 weeks, loon chicks are actually able to walk closer to like a mallard duckling to be able to move across land to get to another lake where there's more fish so you can support the family, for example. So that's what I was wondering what might have happened was this loon chick was probably potentially walking across land to get to another lake. And Bill may have just kind of accelerated that process. And ultimately, right, there'd be a tremendous curiosity to know what happened, right? And we have heard stories of loons adopting potentially other chicks, for example. And so that parent, if they lost their nest or lost their young, they may have adopted that chick, for example. So great story. I really appreciate sharing that.
We are talking to Jim Peruke right now. He's the author of Loon Lessons, Uncommon Encounters with the Great Northern Diver, and he has been studying loons for nearly three decades. You know, part of studying loons, it's certainly gotten much more advanced since maybe the Audubon days. How do you go about tracking loons in, 2021?
Yeah, and I think what we've learned is that radio transmitters work fairly well. So that's a technique that's been used in wildlife management. But that works for small-scale movements. But for large-scale movements, so for example, to follow loons, that hatch in Wisconsin ultimately to determine where they winter. So kind of connecting the migratory pathway between breeding and wintering, you know, we would use satellite telemetry. And so that's become more sophisticated. And now you essentially, like, I would hire like a wildlife vet, for example, to conduct the surgeries. They would implant the satellite transmitter, the little antenna would stick out from the loon, and then the satellites orbiting the Earth would pick up that signal, and then we could plot those locations on an Earth, for example, and we'd be able to kind of get locations of those individuals.
Have you found any sort of surprising new information from tracking loons this way?
Well, one thing that I was off the coast of Louisiana, and we put two satellite transmitters in loons in the Gulf of Mexico. And these individuals flew all the way to northwest Saskatchewan, so over 2,700 miles. That's the longest distance migrant that we know of loons. So imagine flying that far. Northwest Saskatchewan is actually closer to the Pacific coast. Mm-hmm. So you wonder if some loons there go to the Pacific coast. And I just want to kind of shout out a couple of names real quickly, JC. You know, other loon researchers, I've really benefited from interacting and reading their work. You know, in Wisconsin, Walter Piper has done tremendous amounts of work in Wisconsin. Kevin Keenow from the USGS has done great work. Mike Meyer with the Wisconsin DNR, retired, just did lots of great work. Jay Mager, who did lots of vocalizations work with Charlie Walcott. And I just wanted to mention some of their names as just contributors and colleagues I've worked with or been able to benefit from their knowledge and what we've learned about loons to kind of tell us a more complete story.
Yeah, it's always great to hear about all of the people participating in work like this because we get to learn more about these really awesome birds. You know, really quickly, as we wrap up, since you just mentioned those biologists, what mystery is still there about the loons? What are you all trying to still, you know, tease out about loons?
Well, the one thing that's missing, right, is physiological studies. We've been able to do physiological studies on penguins. You can kind of put some equipment inside of a penguin and be reasonably assured you're going to be able to re-catch it. With loons in the breeding grounds, it's really hard to re-catch a loon once it's been caught once within, let's say, a day or two or a week. So if we're trying to look at, like, how does climate change impact loons, we really need to know what the physiological limits to loons are in terms of upper temperatures and lower temperatures, whether they feel comfortable to stress. And so for me, that's probably a big one that we're still trying to learn about. And I also think just in continuing to monitor loons to kind of link staging to wintering areas, to breeding areas, would be real important. So we may want to identify places where they stage and to try to protect those. And similarly, on the wintering grounds, we may need to want to protect areas there.
Well, Jim, we'll have to leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Appreciate it. Thank you, Jay Carlisle.
James Peruk has been studying loons for almost 30 years, and he is the author of Loon Lessons, Uncommon Encounters with the Great Northern Diver. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.